tonight on Arena, Donald Clark on last night's Golden Globes, Peggy Seeger talks about her career in activism, and Dido and Aeneas at Classics Now. You're very welcome along to another week of Arena. 51551 if you'd like to text us. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena@rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at @rte_arena. Last night, the 83rd annual Golden Globe Awards took place at the Beverly Hilton in Los Angeles, hosted once again by American comedian Nikki Glaser. The ceremony celebrated the best in film, television and, for the first time, podcasts from 2025. Irish Interest focused on Hamnet, with acting nominations for Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, and for Irish author Maggie O'Farrell, who co-wrote the screenplay with director Chloe Zhao. In the end, Kerry-born Jesse Buckley took the award for Best Actress in a Motion Picture Drama for her role as Agnes in Hamnet, seeing off A-listers like Jennifer Lawrence and Julia Roberts, and the film itself went on to win Best Motion Picture Drama. Film critic Donald Clark joins me now. Donald, first of all, tell us about the Golden Globes. It's kind of considered that fun event that kicks off awards season. It's slightly more loose. It's slightly less, you know, less structured. I mean, who's behind it and who are the voters in this particular instance?
It's one of the great mysteries of awards season. People have been asking for probably 80 years, why the Golden Globes are the ones everyone looks to get a prediction to the Oscars themselves, and why it's seen as the one that kicks off awards season proper, rather than, for example, the Critics' Choice Awards or the Screen Actors Guild Awards, now called the Actors. And I think part of it is what you say. There's always been a notion that it's rather good fun, that for as long as it's been around, that the announcements of the actors have been slightly drowned out with the clinking of glasses and the chuckling of people in the background. So that's always been part of it. And as far as they go, they have a peculiar history. They were established back in 1944. So they are among the oldest as well, to be fair. That's worth clarifying as well. I mean, the Screen Actors Guild Award, for example, actually didn't arrive until the 1990s. So they've been around for a long time. Until 2023, they're run by a small eccentric body of journalists called the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. We won't go into the controversies around all that, but basically there was a bunch of controversies 4 or 5 years ago, around about 2022, and the awards were restructured into a non-profit event that supports a philanthropically inclined organization called the Golden Globes Foundation. They also expanded the number of voters. At that stage, 5 or 6 years ago, it was fewer than 100. It's about 90 journalists, very few of whom you would have heard of. And it's now been bumped up to around 400 diversely selected journalists from all around the world. And I'm going to stand them up and defend them to an extent here, because people have always made jokes about the Golden Globes for reasons I've intimated that I suggested there. But I think they've done a reasonably good job at cleaning themselves up over the last 3 or 4 years, not least in that they're now producing results that are, you know, at least as kind of diverse and engaging as the Oscars. For example, last night, Wagner Moura, the Brazilian actor, won Best Actor in a Drama against some pretty fierce competition. So I think they do a decent enough job. Now, whether they do a decent enough job in predicting the Oscars, insofar as that is a job, insofar as that is or should be their intention, we will get to in a minute, possibly now.
Yeah, that's a very different question. I'm interested in that thing about them changing in the last few years, because there are a lot more people being nominated in films that are not originally in the English language these days.
Agreed. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It's fast. I mean, and also films. I mean, titles. This year there was no question. But this year, for example, in drama, it was Just an Accident, the fine Iranian film, The Secret Agent, we've mentioned, a Brazilian film, A Sentimental Value, a Norwegian film. In musical or comedy, you had Nouvelle Vague, Richard Linklater film, but it's actually entirely in French, and No Other Choice, which is a Korean film. So, I mean, close to half the nominees in drama, the picture nominees in drama, a musical or a comedy, were films not in English. So I think as I said earlier, and as you suggested, I think they deserve some some congratulations for doing that for me. Now, having said that, the Oscars themselves, of course, have become more international over the last 10 or 15 years. Parasite was in 2019, 2020, ceremony 2020, was the first foreign language film, sorry, I shouldn't say foreign language, the first film not in English to win Best Picture in the history of the awards. And since then, considerably more films have been nominated in Best Picture in the Oscars from other languages than there were at any stage in the last 20 or 30. You've got the occasional Bergman film or some point in the 1970s, but now you have a pretty healthy selection of films from outside 50 states, from about 50 states and Britain, which is good to see.
I want to get into some of the winners from last night. We have a couple of clips from the winner's speeches as well. So we have to start with, unless people have been buried in a box all day, they can't have failed to have noticed that Jesse Buckley won last night. It's a bit of history
kind of for... The media has been wrapping itself in the flag all day.
Just a little. Yes. It's been a little bit of history though, because it's the first time an Irish performer has won Best Actress in a Drama.
That's right, yes. I hope I've got this all right. I went back and checked this last night doing my notes. Saoirse Ronan won Best Actress in a Comedy, for Lady Bird in, I think, 2018. So this is the first time that she... Now, again, unfortunately, it's rather unfair to poor old Globes, but the conversation then immediately turns towards the Oscars and these, because, the question then is, will we finally get an Irish-born winner of Best Actress at the Oscars? I mean, that's what people are really interested in. But yes, I think we should hear, 2 months away, 2.5 months away from the Oscars, we should sit back and congratulate her on that achievement, that she is the first Irish person to have won that particular title.
Yeah, let's take a little bit from her acceptance speech last night, and it's a small excerpt from a longer speech. This is Jessie Buckley.
It was such an extraordinary set to be part of because, we were telling the story of probably the most famous Brit that ever lived, and we had a Chinese director, a lot of Irish, a mostly Polish crew, and beside our British family. I'd really like to thank our grip, Tomac, because during shooting, Tomac started to disappear a little bit during the shoot, and I found him one day at the back of his truck, and he was chopping up potatoes and onions and meat, and he was making, and he brought his ginormous cast iron pot over from Poland, and he was making soup, and this soup started turning up on set, so it was delicious. Thanks, Tomac, for bringing your pot to set.
That's some extraordinary soup. Paul Mescal lost out to Stellan Skarsgård in the supporting actor category. Was that a surprise?
No. Paul is in the, I think in some ways, happy position this award season of being along for the ride. I expect him to get a nomination for the Oscars for Best Supporting Actor, which is what he was competing in last night. But that is quite a stuffed category this year. Skarsgård, in fact, wasn't even quite the favourite. I think people were tending towards Benicio del Toro for One Battle After Another, or Sean Penn also for One Battle After Another, or Jacob Elordi for playing the creature in Frankenstein, who he won at the Critics' Choice recently. That was rather against the odds. So that's a very stuffed category, but I would be surprised it wasn't Skarsgård, del Toro, Elordi, Mescal and Penn at the Oscars. I'd be very surprised if Paul Mescal doesn't get in. But I think, as I say, rather like when he was nominated for an After Sun in Best Actor a few years back, he's in some case the happy position of not having much chance of winning, and therefore being able to kind of go around all the various awards season bun fights without too much tension or pressure upon him.
We spoke to Maggie O'Farrell here last week, who wrote the novel of Hamlet and was nominated with Chloe Zhao for Best Screenplay. They didn't win for that, but Hamlet did take Best Film Drama. I saw one article that suggested that Sinners was probably expected to win. So was that an upset on the night?
That does come as an upset, definitely. Not a spectacular upset. I mean, in that people would have said it was in third place. So put it that way. Not a spectacular. I mean, if sentimental value, or of Shafar Panahi's, it was just an accident of one, that would be more of an upset. But I think it was an upset. I think there was people had settled down to the notion that the Best Picture race is a two-horse race between one battle after another, and Sinner is, you know, a few, good few lengths behind. But I mean, you know, notwithstanding my own opinions about Hamlet, and I liked it a lot, I always felt that one thing you should look towards when you're assessing how that film is going to do or was going to do in the upcoming awards season is look at how well it did with audience awards at film festivals. It did really well with audience awards at film festivals. It won at the BFI London Film Festival. It won the similar prize at Toronto International Film Festival, which is one of the most influential audience prizes. And I think what that gets at with those two festivals, you're not just dealing as you would be at Cannes and Venice with critics and professionals. You're dealing with punters. You're dealing with the good citizens of Toronto and the good citizens of London. And I think what that indicates, when people see it, they like it. I mean, that sounds like a banal thing to say, but I think when this film gets out there amongst the voters and the Oscars, the average voters, I think a lot of them will come round to it. I still don't think it's quite favourite for the Oscar, but I always felt that it had a better chance in awards season than other people suggested.
Okay, I want to take something from Chloe Zhao's acceptance speech here.
Paul says something to me this morning. Is it okay if I share?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. He said that making Hamlet made him realize that the most important thing of being an artist is learning to be vulnerable enough to allow ourselves to be seen for who we are, not who we ought to be, and to give ourselves fully to the world, even the parts of ourselves that we're ashamed of, that we're afraid of, that are imperfect, so the people that we speak to, they can also learn to see themselves and fully accept themselves. And I look around this room, there are so many of you that I have known for many, many years, my incredible fellow nominees, and I'm looking at you, Ryan Coogler. I'm looking at you. Sundance Labs. I taught you how to make a fire in your, because it was cold, in your room. But I'm looking at you, and I see so many of you have become so strong and tender at the same time, and you have shared so much of yourselves in your work to the world. So I salute to your bravery, and I salute your dedication. And let's do this together. Let's keep our hearts open, and let's keep seeing each other, and let's keep allowing ourselves to be seen. Thank you.
Who do you think is going to be most disappointed by the awards last night, Donald?
Last night? Well, that's a good question. I mean, I suppose, possibly... Michael B. Jordan, who would have thought he had a decent chance in Best Male Actor, I would have thought would be one suggestion there. I mean, I think probably everybody in Best Supporting Actor, which we were discussing earlier, with maybe the exception of Paul Mescal, thought they had a chance there. I think probably of the actors, I would say... I think somebody who had a lot of momentum behind her and it has slowed a little bit last night would be Amy Madigan in Best Supporting Female Actor in a Motion Picture, who was Gladys in Weapons. This very big, noisy performance as this sort of witchy figure. She probably felt that she'd a good chance of getting in there and marking her territory in the awards season. Just to go, you've been playing the speeches, and I think we should say, people are wondering, look, if we're talking about this is only, you know, 400 people voting, and it's, you know, why is it of any importance? Well, one way it's important is if you make a good speech. The speeches tend to matter, and I think that's one thing going in Jessie Buckley's favour is, while being very natural and unpretentious, she is very good at the microphone. And that speech will have gone round, and people will have heard the anecdote about the Polish stew and so forth, and that will have done her no harm at all. And I think if you make a good speech, that does wonders for the rest of your season.
Yeah, let's take one more I just want to do here, because it's not just movies that the Globes celebrate, it's TV dramas as well. Stephen Graham's Adolescence won again, not just Graham and not just Owen Cooper and Erin Doherty winning last night. They do a little bit of this. This is Owen Cooper, young Owen Cooper's speech.
You know, what started off as what I thought, you know, I might be okay at, I might be awful at it, I never know. So I took a risk and I went to drama classes. I was the only boy there. It was embarrassing, but, you know, I got through it. And, but, you know, thank you, thank you. But I'm still very much an apprentice. I'm still learning every day. I'm still learning from the people that I sat in front of you, sat in front of me, who's inspired me. I wouldn't be here without you guys. So, I mean, it's mad what is going on.
I want to make a very brief mention, maybe, Donald, of the Golden Globes adding a new Best Podcast category. That seems a strange one.
They are incorrigible and eccentric. That you have to give them that. But, I mean, you know, that is only slightly madder than the Golden Globe Award for Cinematic and Box Office Achievement, which has been going for 3 years. Nobody can understand what it actually means. To the extent that this year, that one of the nominees was Avatar, which had not made a penny when the nominations came out because it hadn't been released. Another was K-pop, which was a, you know, streaming release. So, I mean, that is. But anyway, to answer your question, it's as if they think podcasting is now a screen event. Is that what we think? Because we are increasingly reading these articles saying that people are watching, people like you and me, are being watched on their computers at when people are watching podcasts or radio shows, whereas they used to listen to them on their headphones or while driving their car. But I mean, you know, if you say that, I mean, the Globes don't give out awards for game shows or chat shows, so that doesn't really make any sense either. It just feels like a slightly desperate attempt to grab the zeitgeist. And as often is the case with, you know, venerable organizations, when they grab the zeitgeist, they're grabbing it about, you know, 5 or 10 years too late. I mean, it's not as if podcasts arrived yesterday. They've been around long enough for people to wonder what on earth it's doing here. And there's an interesting piece in the New York Times about this, where Abby Rositsky, who's a podcast herself, pointed out that the issue seems to be, problem is they're treating it as a genre when it's now an industry, that it's sort of like awarding the prize for the best television program in every category, including news and drama and whatever. So it doesn't make an enormous amount of sense, and I don't think it's really going to win them much kudos for being hip, which I think is what they want to be.
Film critic Donald Clark, thanks for joining us as always. The highlights of the 83rd Annual Golden Globe Awards start tonight on RTE2 and the RTE Player at 9 o'clock. You are listening to Monday Night's Arena. Is the Overture to Dido and Aeneas by composer Henry Purcell, performed by the Grammy Award-winning soprano Jessie Norman in the version we're going to play you a little bit later on. It's a monumental work in Baroque opera, sometimes called the first English operatic masterpiece. Based on the poet Virgil's Aeneid, which was written over 2,000 years ago, the opera tells of love and tragedy between Dido, the Queen of Carthage, and the Trojan hero Aeneas. The story's been represented in art and music down the centuries, and later this month it'll be performed at the Royal Irish Academy of Music as part of the Classics Now Festival. Dido's Lament will feature mezzo-soprano Sharon Carty, and its stage director is Conor Hanratty, who joins us on the line this evening from Miami. Good evening, Conor.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. What has you in Miami?
I am currently here directing the operetta Die Fledermaus, which, just listening to the overture there, could not be more different to the Baroque splendor and tragedy that we're bringing to Classics Now in a few weeks' time.
And that's with the Florida Grand Opera. I mean, perhaps we don't think of Florida as being a location of Grand Opera, maybe when the first time we think about that.
Well, would you believe, they have told me this, it is the fourth oldest opera company in the United States. It has been long established here in Miami, and one Pavarotti made his American debut with this company. So there's a fine history here.
I understand that you also watched Hamnet in a dingy cinema in Miami over the weekend. Are the Golden Globes, is the excitement, has it reached the that part of the East Coast?
Well, if nothing else, I will be bringing it into rehearsal today. Let me tell you, we're all very proud of our Jesse.
At the end of the month, you'll be back in Ireland directing Dido's Lament. We're going to hear the voice of Jesse Norman performing When I'm Laid in Earth. Tell us more about the live performance in Dublin and what it's all going to entail.
Well, it's a part of Classics Now, which is fast becoming one of my favourite festivals in the calendar, spearheaded by the brilliant Helen Meaney, who has put together, I suppose, an opportunity every January for nerds like me and lovers of the classical worlds of Greece and Rome, whichever way they crop up. And Helen very kindly invited me a few years ago to consider Dido as a potential starting point for a programme or a performance of some sort. And I have the privilege of calling Sharon Carty a friend of mine. And one of her great party pieces, shall we say, is Dido's Lament itself. She sings it better than most people in the game today. So with that as the rock on which I shall build my church, says I, we went through the variety of artistic responses, both in text and in music, down the centuries, if not the millennia, mainly as an excuse to get a Dublin public the opportunity to hear Sharon sing this, because she sings it so, so beautifully. And we found that there's quite a substantial quantity of both text and music. So we're going to give an audience a kind of a potted history of both Dido's story and also of the literature and music that she has inspired.
And some readings and poems as well, as I understand it.
Exactly. I shall be doing the reading and Sharon shall be doing the singing, because it would be rubbish if it was the other way around. I was just going to say, we've taken readings from Virgil himself, who inspired the opera, all the way through various other Latin poets, like Ovid has a much more interesting, different and passionate response to her being taken over by love. And then leading right the way, our final piece of it will be from Seamus Heaney's translation of Book 6 of Virgil's Aeneid, in which Aeneas, as part of his big heroic quest, has to go to the underworld, and he meets Dido's ghost, and she refuses to speak to him because their love has been very tragic and led to very terrible things. But through the course of this as well, we've also found some pretty beautiful pieces of music, including what we're telling ourselves might be an Irish premiere. If anybody out there can let us know if we're wrong, we're happy to hear that too. But we found a piece by Schubert, which is a setting of an Italian libretto for yet another Dido opera. But Schubert, in his own way, turned it into a much more intimate song setting. And Sharon, being brilliant both at Baroque and at German repertoire, we're bringing all of her skills to the table, and she's going to perform that as part of the programme as well.
It must be fairly extraordinary to be given such a blank canvas and to be allowed to take whatever you want and then fill that canvas with so many different varied ideas and composers and ways of bringing that story to a public.
It's a great privilege. I'm very lucky, because this is not even the first time that Helen has let me do this. A couple of years ago, we made another program for the National Concert Hall, also as part of Classics Now, which was Eurydice and Orpheus. And again, I had singing and spoken texts woven together from both of the perspectives of those doomed lovers. And this time we're giving voice to Dido alone.
Dido and Aeneas, Henry Purcell's version, it's regarded as a masterpiece. It's one of the most important operas of all time. But I'm interested to know what makes it deserving of that description as far as you're concerned.
Well, as you pointed out earlier, it is one of the earliest English masterpieces. Purcell himself wrote quite a huge quantity of music, both for public life, for royalty, and for the stage. And Dido and Aeneas in particular is such a special piece of music. It's not a very long opera. Perhaps Sharon and I are putting down a marker. If anybody would like us to put on the whole opera, you can come and talk to us after the show. But its particular highlight, I suppose, is the lament itself, which we have named our whole event after. Dido sings at the end of her life, because this doomed affair with Aeneas has gone from bad to worse. And the only way out she can see is to end her life. But before she does so, she sings this spectacular, haunting lament for herself.
Well, I think let's take a moment from that. It is Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. And here it is performed by Jesse Norman. And the wonderful Jesse Norman singing Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. Conor Hanratty is still with me. Conor, it's been more than 2,000 years since Virgil wrote the Aeneid. Why the story of Dido and Aeneas? Why do you think that inspires so many artists across so many genres and still fires the creative imagination?
Well, I think particularly today, the Dido is fascinating. She herself was a refugee. She came to a new city. She founded Carthage. She has built a new place for her people. And then this Roman hero arrives and they have this, you know, God-anointed, passionate love affair. But then, of course, another god tells Aeneas that it's time to go because he likewise has to go and found a certain empire called Rome. And unfortunately, she's collateral damage. So it is this sort of the stress and the panic and the pressure between a personal life and one's duty to the homeland, whichever that's going to be, and these are stories that never really go out of fashion. Dido herself is particularly dramatic in a good way because she has all of the feelings and she does follow through with how she's feeling when she feels that she has nothing else to face. And certainly when you have the likes of Purcell giving her something like that to sing, as we've just heard, you can see how she became such a heroine.
It's part of the greater classics now. Maybe tell us a little bit more about the festival, which takes place over the course of a weekend at the end of the month.
Well, this year there's an embarrassment of riches. There are events about Plato. There's a new piece in development by the brilliant Colin Murphy. Natalie Haynes is returning to the festival. She of the great podcast, if not necessarily Golden Globe winning podcast just yet, but she of Standing Up for the Classics has a new book about Medea to come and talk to us about. There's a huge range, all on, of course, on the website classicsnow.ie. But what's brilliant about it is that the variety of events are both online and in person. There's a guided tour of the Classics Museum in UCD in Belfield, where I did my work experience when I was in transition year. So there's a range of events for every kind of classical interest. And I think the tagline of the festival is the future of the past, which I think is brilliant. Certainly, we're always welcoming new people to come and explore what Helen has put together.
And all I can do is wish you the best of luck both with the event for Classics Now and with the rest of your afternoon as well in Florida. Are you heading straight to rehearsals now?
I'm on my way out the door now to stage the finale of Act 2. God help us.
Conor Hanratty, stage director, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure talking to you.
Dido's Lament will be a live performance with mezzo-soprano Sharon Carty, harpsichordist David O'Shea and director Conor Hanratty on the 30th of January in the Vernon Studio in the Royal Irish Academy of Music in Dublin. It's taking place as part of this year's Classics Now Festival, taking place both online in Dublin and beyond as well. This year's focus is the future of the past. It all happens from the 30th of January to the 1st of February and you can find more details at classicsnow.ie. Now, sitting across from me is a woman who's been touring and performing for over 7 decades. She is one of the greatest folk musicians around, who has seamlessly woven her political activism and her feminism through her music. She's a legend of folk music whose brain, talent and spirit drove her through a long, successful 70 years and counting career. Peggy Seeger, welcome to Arena.
Thank you. I'm blushing with that introduction.
You're back in Ireland for Tradfest and for a tour as well. But, and I'm absolutely sure this isn't true, it's alleged this is a farewell tour. You're only 90 years old, Peggy. You can't be giving up touring at this point.
Actually, my farewell tour was in May and June, the tour. At present, I'm actually appearing here in Ireland and doing 3 songs. But it's not a tour because I've given up touring. Touring is gone and I've done it for 70 years or more. Touring involves a lot of travel, very little sleep, motorway food, and meeting friends that you want quality time with but have no time because you're headed for the next place you're going.
Is it a hard thing to give up after it being such an important part of your life over the course of your entire adult life?
Well, if I was still fit, or if I were still fit, I would say it would be hard to give up. But I'm not fit anymore. We had our last tour last year. That's us. That's me and my 2 sons and our manager and a sound engineer. And the preparations, the physical trouble of touring. When I say trouble, it's very taxing. It's very time sensitive. You know exactly where you're going to be 6 days from now at 10:15 in the morning. And I'm not up to that at the age of 90. I figure at 90 I should be sitting back and looking and seeing how can I be the most useful now without galloping around doing the ego thing on stage, because anyone who gets up on stage has to have a pretty good amount of ego to say, look at me, here I am. I want to share this with you. The part that isn't ego is something that just wants everybody in the audience to be together. I could go on over and over if we had the time to talk about the word audience. But what you're doing when you sing in a concert is you're gathering a whole group of strangers together in a temporary community. And because of folk music, because of the things that they hold in common, it's a very a fantastic feeling that is much more than just your person being on stage. So I miss a lot of that. But I'm ready to do other things.
Maybe I would like you to talk a little bit about that idea of audience and that idea of collectivity and that idea of togetherness that comes through music.
Well, the word audience is tied to the word audio, and it suggests that all they do is listen. But believe me, they do much more than that. I used to travel totally on my own. I would not do it now. I love traveling with my team, although each of them talks about their team and I'm part of their team. And when I traveled on my own, you could tell what the audience was like before you even went on stage, because I never allowed background music before I came on stage. Their ears have to be fresh. You can tell by the way they interact. But the word audience suggests that all they do is listen, but they don't. They contribute in so many ways. You can tell whether you're hitting the button, somebody in the front row falls asleep. You have to feel, okay, got to wake them up. Let's sing a song with heavy banjo and whoa, they're ready and ready. But audience is more than listening. It's participating and getting them to participate. It's not only folk song that does that. A lot of popular singers who have you up in the mosh pit and you're waving your arms, they know how to do it too. The audience wants to be a community. They want to share. And it's a very small word for a very big thing.
I want to ask you about your sons, Neil and Callum McCall. They've been part of your touring crew. Was that an important thing for you?
Oh, they've been more than part. It wouldn't have happened without any member, the four members. And in case you can't remember, that's my manager, sound engineer, Callum and Neil. But Callum and Neil played another part in that we made up songs together. We understand each other actually with the nuts and bolts of music. And we are a team. We don't argue about the way this or that song is being done. We mull it over. We add or take away a break here or change instruments. Because they've been playing with me from their early teens, with me and Ewan, they played us when with us they traveled to Canada. They traveled to the United States playing and traveling. Teenage boys, imagine that. And so we've been going a long time. And it was hard for them, for me to give up. I think Neil, the oldest one, who's 66 now, I think he was quite teary on our last concert. And it was our last concert. And it was in Dunleary, which I've only just learned how to spell.
That takes a while sometimes. You've been visiting Ireland and touring in Ireland since your early days as a performer. If I have it right, you first came here in 1956. What was it like touring Ireland in those days?
I didn't tour it. I was with a woman called Deanne Hamilton, whom I'm sure you have heard of. And she was here to record field singers. She was recording Paddy Tunney. I met Paddy Tunney in 1956 out in Letterkenny. I met the McPeaks, and I didn't know how important they were at the time. I was accompanying her because she needed, I don't know if she needed me, but I think she wanted a fellow country person. She was American. I was American. I've since sworn allegiance to the Queen years and years ago. But I was green as grass in 1956. I was only 21. So, I mean, I was gobsmacked when I came to Ireland. It was, I couldn't understand a lot of the dialect and of the actual, and the Gaelic, I couldn't. But not, it's strange, not so many people spoke Gaelic back then. So many do now. Fabulous.
I've read, and I don't know how true this is, that you don't consider yourself as having a so-called good voice, and I'm using very large air quotes there. What do you mean by that?
Well, I would like to know what people mean when they say she has such a beautiful voice. That, not that they say that about me, but if you say someone has a beautiful voice, what do you think of? You think of Maria Callas. You think of Roberta Flack, who sang The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. These are voices which almost stand on their own, that they would only need to sing scales or hum a melody and people would stand stock still in the street. My voice is not like that. And Ewan McCall called my voice a character voice, which means I think that I don't have a specialty. I can sing fast, quick punch at things like Gilbert and Sullivan. I can't sing opera because I don't have a diaphragmatic voice. Mine is a throat voice and a head voice. And because I sing a number of different kinds of folk music, funny songs, lullabies, sea shanty. I don't sing sea shanties, but I can sing, the ox driver's song, which has a yell in the middle like, woo! It doesn't tear my voice out. Maria Callas could probably do that. But it isn't a voice that's listening to itself while I sing. And I think quite a number of people with beautiful voices, you have this funny feeling that part of their attention is on the song and part of the attention is on their voice, because it gives them such a pleasure to feel this vibrating thing in their head. So that's the closest I can say.
Now that you've mentioned the first time ever I saw your face written by the late, great Ewan McCall about you because he was infatuated with you, looking back at that song and how many people find it so important in their lives, how do you see it after all these years?
Well, he never sang it in public. He never sang it other than over the phone. And I thought he meant it as me to sing to him. So I sang it, I made an accompaniment. He wanted it to be like a bird singing. And Roberta Flack, he used to say he wrote it as an hors d'oeuvre, and Roberta Flack turned it into the main course. My version lasted, I think, 2.5 minutes, and hers lasted 5 minutes. I've forgotten the question, but I'm sure it was an important one. How does it make me feel?
Yeah.
Well, I've had two life partners, one male, one female. I've been there, done both. And when I sing the song, I honour both of them. And remembering that, you know, there's three verses to the song. It's like a folk song. It has what's called incremental repetition, where they open with the same phrase, the first time ever I. And that leads you on to the next stage and the next side. It's like saying once upon a time and then saying once upon a time, as if you're beginning anew with each verse. And, of course, that's what you do in a love affair. And I'm glad you used the word infatuated, because I think that's what he was, infatuated with me. But it happens to a lot of men when they're 41 and you're 21 and they tell you they're 39. And then we lived together for 33 years. I think he got over it.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and the stars were the gift you gave to the dark and empty skies, my love, to the dark and empty skies. The first time kissed your mouth. I felt the earth move in my hand. Like the trembling heart of a captive bird that was there at my command, my love, that was there at my command.
I want you to ask you about your political activism, because at this stage, do you think there is enough of that in music these days in 2026?
We used to call it protest songs, and many of the protest songs were written because there were large groups of already melded people to sing them. You had the union movements, you had towns where everybody was a miner or everybody was a weaver or everybody worked in the steelworks, and a protest song would make sense of that. But if you sing a protest song to a group of disparate people who are each acting on their own, like XR Rebellion, and who have not been trained to sing together as they glue their hands to the highway, which is an amazing thing to do, it's hard to know what kind of a song. You can't sing here we go with your hands glued to the highway. People don't sing anymore for themselves. They chant, but they don't sing like we did on the Aldermaston marches.
I want to ask you about your half-brother, Pete Seeger, mm-hmm. as well. He was so influential in the folk music scene and in a sphere of political activism around that as well. What sort of influence was he on you early on?
Well, I left the States when I was 20, and I never really went back until 1995. And Pete was always around. His strength was making songs that people could sing. I don't think he ever mentioned particular, by name, politicians, except one called Mr. Bilbo. It's a song that was made in the 1930s sometime about a man who hated immigrants. And it's a wonderful period song. But the fact that he didn't mention names meant that people could sing them. He changed We Will Overcome to We Shall Overcome. And you say, okay, Pete Seeger did that. But sometimes his songs are too general. They can be taken by anybody. We Shall Overcome was one of Lyndon Johnson's favorite songs as he went into Vietnam. So, pardon me, public, for raising my voice.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday.
You once said that the one artist you always returned to was Paul Simon. And I kind of am asking you that question, but I'm asking you about it in the context of the song you wrote about him for your most recent album.
Well, I didn't write him myself. My son Callum and I wrote it in tandem. And I think I'm more of a Paul Simon fan than he is. He knows more about pop music. He has a wider knowledge of it. But I absolutely love Paul Simon's songs, especially his early ones. It's something that I appreciate with some of the musicians. With some of the musicians I heard this morning at the Tradfest launch of their 21st birthday, for which I thank them tremendously, there was a particular fiddle player, an older man who looked like your Paddy Tunney here. I had to just tell him, that was wonderful, accompanying your two daughters. You knew what to leave out. And Paul Simon knew what to leave out. when he sings where the Statue of Liberty is sailing away to sea. But tomorrow's another working day and I'm wanting to get some rest. All of a sudden, he makes a correlation that seems to have nothing to do with the first two verses of the song. So he pins an emotion in this area of action and then another verse in a related area of action. It's just beautiful.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right, just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home. So far away from home.
I want to ask you, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation about how no longer touring is going to give you time to do other things. So what are those other things?
Well, I am, like a lot of people, appalled at the lack of attention to the one issue that now could unite the whole human race, which is a climate catastrophe. And it is a catastrophe now. It's not just climate change. It is going to be catastrophic. The only thing that everybody can do is something on their own patch. We can't, me personally, can't make the government do this or that, but we can do this little thing, that little thing. It's called the blessed unrest from underneath. If everybody puts a drop in the bucket, however small that drop, the bucket will overflow.
Peggy Seeger, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Arena. Peggy Seeger will be in conversation at the Seamus Ennis Centre in the Knoll as part of Tradfest on Friday, January 23rd. She'll be taking to the stage as part of Transatlantic Women, a night of music and dance curated by Mairead Niweni on January the 24th, and that's in the National Stadium in Dublin. You'll find information for all of those at tradfest.com.